Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, for today's program, I want to discuss Eric Arthur Blair's childhood and his schooling years. Now, this is important if we'd understand why he chose the pen name George Orwell. Now, it was the famous English poet William Wordsworth who wrote, "The child is the father of the man." Now, this treasure of wisdom is embedded in his poem, "My Heart Leaps Up." Now, every boy's childhood does make the man, so I think you'll find this program very interesting. Now, to help me do this, again, I'll be using quotes from the Great Courses series of lectures titled George Orwell, A Sage for All Seasons, and Michael Sheldon's authorized biography, Orwell. Now, Michael Sheldon is also the lecturer for the Great Courses series. For this program, as not to confuse you, I'm going to use Orwell's real name, Eric Blair, or Eric Arthur Blair, and for this podcast. But then after this podcast, we're going to just use the name George Orwell for all future podcasts, especially when we're talking about his classic novel, 1984. Now, the last time I did talk with you about Eric Blair's parents, and I think if you paid attention to that podcast, I think we all would have to admit or maybe recognize that Eric Blair came from a dysfunctional family. Family dysfunction is so pervasive today, you know, only few will even talk about it. And sometimes we fail to understand its negative impact on children and society as a whole. Now, it's not really my aim to get off topic with this program, but it only makes sense that his father's involvement in the Imperial Service as an opium trade agent was a root cause of the family's dysfunction. And I'm going to give you some reasons why. Now, the obvious reason is Richard Blair lived separately from his family for years. And here's what Michael Sheldon has to say about that. This is page 12 of his biography. It says, Eric Blair had always desired his father's good opinion, but he had never been able to establish a close relationship with him, in large part because they had spent so little time together during Eric's childhood. Until he was 8, he barely saw his father, who was always away in India. By the time Mr. Blair returned home to enjoy his retirement, his son was away at boarding school, and their subsequent time together during school holidays was short and generally uncomfortable. Looking back on the period, Eric Blair, or Orwell, wrote that his father had appeared to him simply as a gruff-voiced elderly man forever saying, "Don't." So that reminds me of not so much my father, but of my grandparents. They were always telling me, "Don't." And also, my grandfather would always call me the Democrat, which really bugged me. I don't think I even knew what it meant. But now I know what it means. And I was justified in being upset with it all. So here, for his first 8 years of his life, he really never saw his dad too much. Now, I think it's interesting that in 1907, so if you remember back to last program, Eric Blair was born in, I think, 1905. And so the summer that he would have been 4, his dad showed up for 3 months. And so here's what Michael Sheldon has to say about that. It says, nothing is known of his reaction to his father's brief appearance in Henley during the summer of 1907. But it must have been a curious experience to have him at home on a 3-month leave. Suddenly, there was a man living in the house, and then just as suddenly, he disappeared, not to be seen again for 4 years. Eric was barely 4 at the time and probably did not remember much about it later. There is no comment upon it anywhere in Orwell's writings, though he does make it clear in his essay, Why I Write, that his sense of loneliness in childhood was partly related to his father's long years of separation from the family. He definitely regretted not having his father at home during those crucial early years, but it is unlikely that Mr. Blair would have ever been capable of giving him the strong affection and guidance he craved. The old gentleman was not the type to establish a close bond with anyone, least of all with children, whose activities hardly interested him. So even that's kind of heartbreaking, even to read. And I know that even as I was growing up, I mean, we were a Roman Catholic family. My father was able to, with my mother, produce seven siblings or seven children. And I know my father worked very hard, and sometimes he had to work two jobs. And I think all of us felt that we wished he had been more involved with all of us. And so I don't think what Eric Blair experienced is much different than a lot of young people experience. But I think I think one of the things we have to understand is that Mrs. Blair, or her name, first name was Ida, would have been the dominant adult in his life. And here's what Sheldon has to say. He says, Mrs. Blair and her chicks, as she liked to call her children, made their new home in the Oxfordshire market town of Henley-on-Thames. They lived at its southern end in a quiet neighborhood with wide streets, near gardens and attractive villas of recent construction. Now, I don't know if Michael Sheldon really had the idea of, it's like Mrs. Blair, but maybe he's comparing her to a hen with her chicks, but obviously the rooster was not around. And so you can see how probably the children were very dependent. Now, in that little visit in 1907, remember, they were together long enough that there was a third child produced at that time, and that's Eric's younger sister, Averill. And so I guess he was gone again for another 4 years after that. So, but there were no more children after the return from retirement. So anyway, I do think that is something that, we really have to take notice of. When a dad is not in the home, that really does cause a lot of dysfunction. Now, just to kind of give credit to Mrs. Blair, she did, I think, do the best she could with what she had, and she really tried to give her children a good life, and maybe as best as middle class as she could. Now, also in the last program, remember, I think we mentioned that, Mr. Blair did really not like the fact that his son was really involved or wanting to be involved with literature. And of course, he wanted him to go into the Imperial Service like he had been. But there was something very special about Eric Blair that his mother noticed very early on. And in some ways, maybe it worked out for the best that his dad was not home all the time. But here's what Sheldon says about this. He said, his mother was the first to recognize his talent for words, and she encouraged it. Orwell liked to claim that the urge to write had been with him since early childhood. In his 40s, he recalled composing a poem when he was only 4 or 5. The poem was about a tiger with a chair-like teeth, and his mother had proudly written it down while he recited it to her. His first published poem appeared in a local newspaper when he was 11. Orwell believed that his early literary activity was partly the result of a lonely boyhood. I had the lonely child's habit of making up stories and holding conversations with imaginary persons, and I think from the very start my literary ambitions were mixed up with a feeling of being isolated and undervalued. So I can understand that somewhat. I grew up with bronchial asthma, and I had three brothers, and as they went off to play baseball and football and the things they liked to do, I had to stay at home because I was allergic to so many things. And of course, one of the biggest things I was allergic to was dust. And so I almost died actually from a asthmatic attack over dust. And so again, I did spend a lot of time reading, and I did not have any made up playmates though, but I was a good storyteller. I could say that much. And also in the fifth grade, I wrote a poem, and it was entered in a national poetry contest, and I actually won. I actually won as a fifth grader. But I don't remember anybody necessarily complimenting me on literature and writing. And in fact, my dad said, you know, I really would like you to go onto the railroad. And he had been working on the Pennsylvania Railroad, and he thought that would be the best job for me. Well, I think certainly I had different ideas than that, and I got some help that I needed to get help with, and I went on to college and then on to graduate school after that. So, and here I am today on the radio. So anyway, I do think it's interesting that his mother did see value in what he liked to do. Now, again, I think we're still on this whole idea of the dysfunctional family. Now, essentially, what Eric Blair's father did is he just sent money home from India. And so he sent her about 400 pounds a year. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of money to us, but at that time, it would have been about $50,000 a year. And so it's not that they were poor. And with the price of everything at that time, I'm sure they lived really, really pretty well. There's one thing that we need to say about his mom as well. And she was pretty much a socialite. And so in other words, I think Eric probably ended up spending a lot of time with his sister Marjorie. And here's what Sheldon has to say about all of this. He says, Ida's diary for her first complete year in Henley has survived, and the entries reveal that the young mother of two led an active social life. She seems to have enjoyed herself thoroughly. She played bridge, croquet, tennis, and golf, and took long walks in Henley Park or along the river. She had entertained friends at home and gave small parties for Marjorie. She made several trips to London, where Nellie Limousin lived. The journey took little more than an hour on the Great Western Railway. And one week in June, she visited Kew Gardens, saw Sarah Bernhardt on stage, attended a lecture at Manson House, and went to a dog show. Now, what a horrible thing to go to a dog show. But anyway, in July, she spent three full days on the river enjoying the Henley Regatta. And just a few days later, she was at Wimbledon to watch the tennis finals. And so I think that's interesting. So you put that into the mix, and I think you can begin to understand Eric Blair's life. I mean, he was surrounded by the feminine attention and surrounded by feminine things. Can you imagine him being taken to parties with his sister Marjorie and being around all those little girls when he would rather be doing boy things? In his Great Courses lecture, Michael Sheldon does suggest that Eric Blair realized his family was dysfunctional. And in the 1940s, he did write a really kind of a deep essay on England. And he compared England to a dysfunctional family. And so the point I've been trying to make with this all along is generally, if you have an author, they do write from their own experience. And so I think Sheldon has something here when he thinks that Eric Blair knew the family was dysfunctional. Here's what he writes, and actually this is what he said in his lecture, but I have a transcript of his lecture. He says in his lecture, "It is in this shadowy imperial twilight that Eric Blair came of age and began to take stock of the world around him." Now this is 1940, and this is really at the time the British Empire was waning. Obviously, in the 1940s, it finally was having its last gasps in the 1960s. And even I remember being in high school in the 60s and just being aware that the British Empire was going down. And one of the classes, the history classes I took, was on all of the imperial colonies in Africa were beginning to secede from the empire. But he says, "It is in the shadowy imperial twilight that Eric Blair came of age and began to take stock of the world. By 1940, he summarized everything in an inspired image of England as a dysfunctional family." Now, here's a quote from this essay, and he's talking about England. It says, "It resembles a family, a rather stuffy Victorian family, with not many black sheep in it, but with all of its cupboards bursting with skeletons. It has a rich relations who have to be kowtowed to, and poor relations who are horribly sat upon, and there is a deep conspiracy of silence about the source of the family income." If you think about that, it does, as Sheldon says, except for the part about the rich relations, he could have been describing his own family. In his case, all those heavy chests of opium dispatched by his father year after year to China were at the heart of the deep conspiracy of silence. And so he was probably brought up to believe that, hey, we just don't talk about dad's job, and dad's gone. And so I think that that really does show an impact, you know, in a family situation. And I know that there were times, even in our own families, when, well, there's just certain things we heard, but we just didn't talk about. And so you know, that's just the way it is in life sometimes. Now, I'd like to move on now and just tell you that I don't want to paint it so negative about Eric Blair's childhood, because he really did have, even what he considered, some very wonderful years at Henley-on-Thames. If you get on the internet, you can find current pictures of Henley-on-Thames, and I've spent a lot of time in England. I do have a daughter that does live in Stratford-upon-Avon, and so we visited the country very, very, very often as we can. And there's some really picturesque communities. And of course, Eric did spend his young years in a very pleasant English picturesque Oxfordshire market town called Henley-on-Thames. And so, you know, it was really, you know, just one of those beautiful, beautiful places. And it was just idyllic in terms of, you know, the environment and the trees and the lush fields and the beautiful river. And, of course, even the royals had their royal regatta in that area every summer. And so it was a big, big social occasion for that community. Here's how Sheldon describes their home. It says their first real home was called Ermadale and was on Vicarage Road. The house was spacious, and there was a servant to help with the cooking and cleaning. As Orwell later remembered fondly, his mother had given the house its name, creating it from the first two letters in each child's name, and that's E-R from Eric and M-A from Marjorie. Now, remember, when they first got there, the younger sister hadn't been born yet. He said she was a loving, attentive mother who was determined to give her children a comfortable, middle-class life. Now, that sounds like a great home to me. And the fact that they did have a servant that helped with cooking and cleaning shows they weren't doing too badly financially. But here's what Orwell, he does talk very fondly about his memories. And essentially what Sheldon tells us, he encapsulated a lot of his thoughts about, we'll just call it Henley, in his novel called Coming Up for Air. Now, that novel is about a worker in London. I think his name is George Bowling. And he wants to escape the responsibilities of his job. He hates living in the city. And he decides he's going to escape to the country. That's the whole idea behind this novel. And the point is, I think that what Orwell did is he just encapsulated this. Here's the way he describes the environment in this novel, Coming Up for Air. And this is a direct quote from the book. And this would be what he remembers from Henley and the environment around Henley. Here's the quote. It says, "The great green juicy meadows around the town and the dust in the lane and the warm greeny light coming through the hazel boughs." And so there's very, it's really kind of a poetic description of, you know, what he remembers from his childhood. Now, here's what Sheldon says. In the novel, he describes the crowded market days. And here's another quote. When, and here's the quote, "chaps with round red faces like pumpkins drove their animals through the streets in the morning hours." So Sheldon goes on then and says, "above all, he recalls life along the river and the simple enjoyment of an hour's fishing." And here's another quote from that novel. "Summer days in the flat water meadows and the blue hills in the distance and the willows up the backwater and the pools underneath like a kind of deep green glass." And so the point is, I think when Eric Blair wrote this novel, he was thinking back to his boyhood days. And by this time in his life, he was going through, you know, a lot of changes. He was going through a lot of difficulties. And Sheldon, he kind of says very clearly that he was trying to kind of get back to some stability in his life. And of course, he would, you know, have fond memories of his childhood and think that was the time that he wishes he could be back to. Here's what he says. As an adult, he was increasingly tempted to idolize the period as a very good time to be alive, claiming in 1943 that a carefree attitude towards life was more possible then than it has been since. Whatever the reality is of it, Edwardian life may have been, he preferred to judge it according to his experience of the stable, prosperous environment in Henley. And so I think there's a lot of us. I know I can remember back, I grew up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. We were in the foothills of the Allegheny Mountains. It was an absolutely beautiful environment. And I remember a lot of time, you know, walking through the woods, especially in the spring and in the fall. The colors were amazing. And there's a lot of times I think about that when maybe life gets a little tough, I do think back on even my time. So it's not unusual for that to happen. All right. So he did spend some really good time, I think, in his young years. Again, I think I mentioned just previously, he did spend a lot of time with his sister Marjorie. And it's interesting, she had many friends, but at that same time, Eric Blair will tell you, as George Orwell, that he couldn't make friends. He had a real difficult time making friends. And in some ways, I think that's really sad. But he spent most of his time with his sister and her friends. And so I think that could be probably tough in many ways. In fact, there was one local boy, and I think this is really kind of fascinating, that Sheldon tells us about. His name was Humphrey Dakin. Now, this Humphrey Dakin, I guess, was kind of like the ringleader of a group of boys in that area. And he actually decided that maybe he would take Eric fishing and teach him how to fish. Now, as it turns out, the reason he did this is he really liked Marjorie. He did not like Eric at all. And so here's what Sheldon says about Humphrey. He says, Humphrey was a doctor's son, and he was the leader of a small group of middle-class boys who played together on the river or in the woods or in the edge of town, building wigwams and pretending to be Red Indians or bold explorers. They were fishing regularly, and Eric was occasionally allowed to come along. In his novel, Coming Up for Air, George Bowling, he's the character in this Coming Up for Air, recalls a childhood adventure with an older gang of boys who had, reluctantly invited him along on a fishing trip. So Sheldon says, look, we've got to believe this is what really happened with Humphrey Dakin. So here's the quote from the book. He said, I was sitting on the grass bank with the rod in my hands and with the flies buzzing around and the smell of wild peppermint fit to knock you down, watching the red float on the green water, and I was happy as a tinker. I felt the rod tighten in my hand. That feeling, wow. The line jerking and straining, and a fish on the other end of it. Now, that sounds really good, but I don't know if that's really what was happening. Here's what Sheldon goes on to say. It says, like young George Bowling, Eric was not really a welcome companion among the older boys. Humphrey Dakin was much taken with Marjorie's good looks and tolerated her little brother's company to please her. This early infatuation resulted a decade later in his marriage to Marjorie, but he never had much respect for her brother. He thought that Eric was too sensitive and weak. He dismissed him contemptuously as the stinking little Eric and an annoying child full of nobody loves me and torrents of tears. So I can relate to some of that myself. Now, I think Sheldon really makes a good summary here. He says, without a father at home or an older brother, Eric was ill-prepared for the rowdy world of bigger boys like Dakin. Now, I think it's really interesting. I mentioned to you that his mother was really a socialite, and there is some thoughts that maybe she had an affair with Humphrey Dakin's dad. So I'm sure that did not make life any better for Eric Blair. All right. So I just want to talk a little bit now about his education. I know, as always happens to me, in these podcasts is that we run out of time. But I do think we could just mention a few things. One thing we have to recognize that Eric Blair was a really smart little kid, and he really was almost a genius. And of course, he would never say that to anybody. One thing about Ida that I think we also could look on as very positively is she was very concerned about her children's education. And that would put a really big burden, financial burden on her. But yet she managed to get Marjorie into a boarding school at age 11. And then she also put Eric into boarding school at age 8. And so it's like a Dickens novel. I mean, can you imagine, you know, him missing his dad anyway, and then all of a sudden he's now cut off from his sister and his mother, and he's sent to a boarding school. So they sent him to St. Cyprian's. Now, if you hear what he has to say about it, I don't know how any saint could be in charge of this school. But here's how Orwell describes it. He actually wrote about this school in an essay called Such Were the Joys. And it says, St. Cyprian's appears to have been a prison camp, cunningly disguised as a top-notch, expensive preparatory school. To make his case against it, he strips away its respectable exterior, reveals a cold, miserable environment where fear and humiliation held sway. He argues that underfeeding was routine, punishments were severe, overcrowding was common, and filth was pervasive. He depicts the headmaster and his domineering wife as sadistic, greedy snobs who held a cynical view of education as nothing more than a mechanical process of cramming facts into young minds. He contends that they seized every opportunity to increase their profits from the school, and that they ruthlessly bullied anyone who challenged their authority. So thorough was their control, he says, that they seemed able to read their pupils' minds and to know which ones were truly obedient and which ones were merely feigning obedience. So that's the school he was at until he was, I think, 11 or 12. And, of course, one of the things he complains most about is he was caned for bedwetting. And, you know, sometimes boys at 8 have that problem, but the way the school handled it is he just beat them. And so anyway, I do think that's, you know, really kind of interesting. Now, the headmistress of the school was Mrs. Wilkes. And I think even Sheldon comes back and says later in this whole little section that she was a tough character. And she was dominant. She dominated her husband. It says, in the 1960s, when she was in her 90s, Mrs. Wilkes was asked to describe her memories of the little boy whom she had known as Eric Blair. She clearly recalled his first day when she had noticed him standing alone with a sad expression on his face. She had tried to comfort him, but he had resisted her soft words and friendly embrace. He even refused to perk up when she had taken him on one of her special outings a day later. In her memory, there was no fault on her part. She saw herself as the beloved mum who had tried best to reach him. The fault was all his. There was no warmth in him, she insisted. So at the age, I guess, what is it? She was in her 90s, but she could recall you know, Eric Blair. All right, so I am out of time for today, and we're going to continue with some of this next time. So next time, though, I do want to tell you that we will be featuring a special podcast. Michael Sheldon, the author of the authorized biography Orwell, will be coming into our studio by telephone to help us understand why Eric Blair, best known now as George Orwell, wrote 1984. So it's going to be an exciting podcast, so don't miss it. Now, in just a few weeks, we will begin our discussion of the first book of this series, the famous classic 1984 by George Orwell. This first selection has some eye-opening instruction as to what is happening right now in world government and on your nightly news. Now, you can buy 1984 at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com, and of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.